The Battle of Kaldiran revealed the utter superiority of Ottoman firearms and the organization of a well-equipped slave army over the traditional means and tactics of warfare waged by a tribal army such as the Gezil Bash. Although the Safavids were quick to adopt artillery after Kaldiran and use it effectively against the Uzbeks in the east, it took them close to a century before they were able to match the Ottomans' capabilities and later defeat them at their own game. The age of the gunpowder empires came to Iran with an experience of defeat, even though its memory predictably toned down in the Safavid official narrative. Ismail's legacy. By the time of his death in 1524, Ismail was a man of gentler and wiser disposition, but also a heavier drinker, with a melancholic mood. In his last years, there was a relative relaxing of his forced conversion policy and fewer devastating campaigns. Staying in the confines of his harem or on his hunting grounds, which he traversed throughout his realm with obsessive regularity, he preferred even more than previously to leave affairs of the state to his vakil, his sada, and his kezilbash chiefs. A poet, a compulsive hunter, and an adventurous lover of women and men, he died a premature death at the age of 37 after a bout of severe depression. A curious mix of unbridled prowess, violent tantrum, princely affection, and a streak of genius, Ismail seemed an unlikely candidate to build an empire. Yet he proved an ideal leader for a messianic enterprise that brought together, within his nascent state, a cacophony of erratic Turkmen chiefs, shrewd Persian administrators, and Arab jurists. Although he was heir to several generations of radicalized Sufism and failed political projects, he harnessed the warlike energies of his Turkmen devotees and diverted them remarkably into a state structure with a lasting future. In this respect, his initiative to adopt Twelver Shiism as a state creed with legal and institutional capabilities was a conscious policy upon which he intended to build a state and a community of believers. Without him, the Kezilbash, whose enemies called them the red-headed heretics, would have remained just that. Ismail's poetic utterances no doubt helped his devotees to believe in his sanctity. A book of Turkish poetry, by the curious pen name Hatayi, presumably someone from Cathay, today's China, was most likely composed by Ismail for his Turkmen followers as inspirational literature. Coloured by pungent anti-Sunni symbols and prophetic claims common to the cult of venerating Ali, the book opens a window into Ismail's mystical world. One poem reads, "My name is Shah Ismail. I am God's mystery. I am the leaders of all the warriors, Ghazis. My mother Fatima, my father Ali. I am the superior, heir, to the 12 imams. I have avenged my father's blood from Yazid, be sure. I am of the Haydari essence. I am the living Khizr, Arabic Khidr, Islamic name for Prophet Elijah, and Jesus, son of Mary. I am Alexander of my contemporaries. You, Yazid, the polytheist and the accursed, look, I am free from your hypocritical Qibla, direction of the Islamic prayer. Prophethood, Nobovat, is for me, and I am the secret of Veloyat, sacred guardianship. I follow the path of Muhammad, the chosen one. I have conquered the world at the point of my sword. I am like the lieutenant, Kanbar, to Ali, the elect. My sire is Safi, my father Haydar. To the audacious, I am the true devotee of Jafar. I am a Husayanid, and I curse Yazid. I am Khatai, and to that king, that is Hussein, I am a servant." The claim to Veloyat, the sacred succession from the Prophet Muhammad, more specifically on behalf of Ali, and following him, Hussein and Jafar Sadek, the sixth Shi'i Imam and the founder of the Jafari Creed, clearly illustrated Ismail's messianic incarnational beliefs, which also extend to the return of Elijah and Jesus. With pride in his lineage, of both the house of the Prophet and the house of Safi, that is, Safi ad-Din Ardabili, he intends not only to avenge the blood of his father, Haydar, but also to wage war against Yazid, the caliph whose armies killed Imam Hussein in the Battle of Karbala in 680, and the Umayyad dynasty. The polytheists and the accursed, who pray to the hypocritical Qibla, thus can be taken as an allusion to his Sunni enemies at home and to the neighbouring Sunni powers whom he conquered. Yet Ismail's vision of the state was neither purely messianic nor juristic. It was primarily based on the Persian model of kingship. The paradigms of royal power were best reflected in his domestic policy and his self-image as a Shah. In the tradition of the Timurid rulers of Iran and the Turkmen dynasties before him, he was an avid connoisseur of Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, and other Persian poetic narratives, which helped him portray himself as the heir to the Persian tradition of kingship. He patronized the production of great illustrated copies of these works, especially after the conquest of Herat. He summoned great painters to his Tabriz court, among them Kamal ad-Din Behzad, 1450-1535, arguably the greatest 16th-century representative of the Persian school of miniature painting. Fascinated by Persian national legends, Ismail named three of his four sons after legendary heroes of the Shahnameh. His oldest, Tahmasp, after the last of the Pishdadid kings. His third son, Sam, a cultivated prince, after the champion of Manuher's court and the patriarch of the house of Rostam. And his last son, Bahram, after the Sasanian Bahram IV, whose romances and hunting exploits, as narrated by the 12th-century Persian poet Nezami, accorded with Ismail's leisurely temperament. And Ismail had good incentive to envision himself as a Shahnameh king, perhaps a Khosro, the prototype of the great Persian king who vanquished the Turanid king Afrasiab, the greatest enemy of Iranzamin. Afrasiab's kingdom, Turan, was routinely associated in the Iranian landscape with the Turks, and more specifically with the Uzbek kingdom of Central Asia. It was not without reason that Ismail's victory over the Uzbek Sheban Khan was celebrated in the Safavid chronicles as a victory over the legendary Turanids. Yet the pervasive power of the Shahnameh over royal memory was not limited to Ismail and the Safavids. Ironically, both Sultan Selim and Sheban Khan, and later Zahir ad-Din Babur Padishah, and his Mughal descendants, viewed their own power in the mytho-historical context of the Persian legends. As it has often been noted, while Ismail was composing poetry in Turkish, his nemesis, Selim I, was composing Persian poetry in the style of the Shahnameh. Later Ottoman sultans were avid collectors of illustrated manuscripts of the Shahnameh and other classical works of Persian literature. The kingship paradigm to which they all subscribed, from the Ottoman Empire to South Asia and Central Asia, offered a common Persianate political culture, despite widening of sectarian divide. Toward the end of his life, Ismail became more engrossed in book illustration and even worked as an apprentice in the royal workshop. He reportedly collaborated in the production of the celebrated copy of what came to be known as the Shahnameh of Shah Tahmasp, one of the greatest examples of Safavid pictorial art. Perhaps filling in the background of a scene depicting one of Khosrow's exploits, one cannot help but wonder whether Ismail was thinking about the Kayanid king's unhappy end when he renounced his throne and disappeared into the mountains. The Shah Tahmasp manuscript itself witnessed a curious fate. Perhaps preempting another invasion, in 1568, Tahmasp presented it, along with numerous other gifts, to Sultan Selim II on the occasion of his accession to the Ottoman throne. After nearly four centuries of safekeeping in the Topkapi Royal Library, the manuscript mysteriously travelled from Istanbul to the shady world of European art dealers. When it eventually came to the possession of Arthur Horton, an American patron of art and chairman of the board of directors of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, he, with the assistance of a renowned Harvard art historian, dismembered the manuscript during the 1960s and 1970s and sold off its illustrations in various auctions. Metropolitan Museum, too, received a fair share. Rise of jurists' authority. The empire that Ismail left to his son and successor, the 10-year-old Tahmasp, reigned 1524 to 1576, had to cope with frequent clashes among the Gezilbash military elite and with Sunni threat on both frontiers. Tahmasp's long reign also proved crucial for consolidation of Shi'ism in Iran. To Tahmasp's credit, the longest-reigning monarch of Islamic Iran was able to harness the colliding forces he had inherited from his father. The Safavid revolutionary zeal was partially channeled into institutions of the state, even though the disruptive ethnic divisions, especially between the Gezilbash and the Tajiks, were never fully resolved. Yet neither internecine quarrels, nor external threats, nor Tahmasp's own character flaws disrupted economic recuperation, cultural efflorescence, and the relative social calm that would turn Safavid Iran into an empire on par with its Ottoman and Mughal neighbours. Tahmasp's era is remembered as an age of clerical consolidation, when Shi'i jurists, Arab emigrants, and indigenous Iranians gained prominence in government and in society at large. Their rise as an interest group was due more to the contingencies of Tahmasp's early reign than to a concerted effort by the jurists themselves. The feud between two Gezilbash factions, the Ostlaju Shamlu in one camp and the Takelu Turkaman in the other, each seeking the regency of the minor Tahmasp, prompted the young Shah to engage in an elaborate balancing act that involved the Shi'i jurists. As he grew more independent, the messianic religion of the Gezilbash was played down, while the status of the ulama, as trustees of legal 12-air Shi'ism, was augmented. Gradually, the incipient Shi'i society of the 16th century began to adopt religious rituals and practices that would remain characteristic of Shi'ism for centuries to come. Intricacies of prayer and fasting, ablution, awareness of ritual pollutants and methods of cleanliness, and the assignment of Sharia-validated gender roles are all examples of how Shi'ism defined the private realm. Friday congregational prayers, the creation of charitable endowments, and the promotion of Muharram mourning rituals were among the public aspects. The career of the prominent jurist Ali ibn Abdul Alil Karaki, died 1534, illustrates the ulama-state bond and the gradual grasp of the jurists over Safavid society. Karaki was a jurist from Jabalia Mil, who had studied in Damascus and Cairo before moving to Najaf, the Shi'i center of learning in southern Iraq. He first came to Iran at Ismail's behest, just after the defeat of the Uzbeks in 1510, to promote correct Shi'ism directly from the mouth of its Arab advocate. As Safavid Iran became more Sharia-oriented, hence offering greater prestige and affluence to the Shi'i jurists, Karaki returned a second time to become the most prominent religious authority during Tahmasp's era. Through a network of patronage, which included both his Arab and Persian students, as well as beneficiaries of endowments and religious dues, Karaki enhanced the jurists' monopoly as teachers and practitioners of Shi'i law. With a sanctified social standing previously unparalleled, a growing mosque following, and many colleagues with conservative proclivities, a new clerical network began to emerge around the jurists that rivaled and in due course superseded the Persian class of landed notables who held sway over the Safavids' religious administration. With near-autonomous judicial authority and a self-assigned right to control sources of religious income, the jurists were a force to reckon with. Karaki's acquisition of such titles as Seal of the Mujtahids and Deputy to the Imam, Naib al-Imam, revealed the assent of the high clergy. His legal opinions, fatwas, were to be emulated not only by his followers, but also by the Shah. In a decree issued in July 1533, the young Tahmasp addressed Karaki by his titles and bestowed on him governance over religious affairs of the land, as well as vast estates in Iran and Iraq as charitable endowments. We ordained that all the esteemed descendants of the house of the Prophet, Sadat, the respected noblemen and notables, the chiefs of the Gezilbash, the ministers, and all other senior members of the lofty state, to consider him, that is, Karaki, as their guide and leader, Pishwa, and in all circumstances demonstrate their obedience and submission to him. Whatever he commands is to be enforced, and whatever prohibits, to be banned. Whoever he wishes to appoint or dismiss from among the officers of the Sharia in the guarded domains of Iran, and among the military judges of the victorious army, he can do so without any further approval. And whomever that noble authority dismisses cannot be reappointed without his approval. In reality, paying homage to Karaki meant granting him the authority to appoint leaders of congregational prayers, Imam Meh Jomeh, throughout the Safavid Empire. Congregational Friday prayer in the absence of the Imam of the Age, an honorific for the Mahdi in Shiism, was a novel practice in contrast to a prohibition by most Shiist jurists in the past. The act not only implicitly confirmed the Safavid state as a legitimate Shi'i power, but also affirmed the jurists' collective authority as deputies of the Mahdi. Equally important, the royal decree endorsed the practice of emulation, taglid, whereby Shi'i followers would abide in all aspects of the Sharia by the rulings of a mujtahid of their choice. Unique to Twelver Shi'ism, taglid became an institution of lasting sway in Iranian history. In exchange, the state earned the legitimacy to collect land taxes in the absence of the Imam of the Age, which up to then was considered legally unattainable. Karaki's free hand in affairs involving Sharia allowed for the demonization of the Sunnis and prompted open cursing of the early Islamic, rightly guided caliphs, while diminishing all forms of nonconformity, at least in the public space. Moreover, autonomy from the office of Sadr, implicit in that decree, in effect foreshadowed the jurist's desire for a semi-independent status in relation to the Safavid state. Clerical consolidation, however, did not ease internal rivalries, especially ethnic ones, or petty envy among the jurists. All through his career, Karaki encountered hostile criticism from other jurists, both Arab and Persian, as well as Safavid officials, for his monopolistic ambitions. He was attacked for his haughtiness and faulty scholarship, including plagiarism. Indeed, much of his work, and works of most jurists of his time, involved tedious commentaries and glosses on works of earlier jurists, on subjects ranging from intricate details of devotional acts to bodily pollutants and ritual acts of cleansing. The only trait of authenticity was in denouncing whatever was different or innovative, or what appeared heretical, what Karaki and his colleagues readily labelled as devious and contrary to the glorious Sharia. This included Sufi orders, even the Safavi order, both open Sunnis and crypto Sunnis, followers of various non-orthodox creeds, and freethinkers. It was not without reason that he composed a treatise on the veracity of resurrection, Ma'ad, an Islamic doctrine that had long troubled many critical minds and raised doubts, particularly in its strict interpretation as a bodily revival of the dead at the Day of Judgment. Other treatises openly and egregiously denounced the Sunni narrative of early caliphs and other Islamic personalities. Denouncing the Sunni other helped reinforcing doctrinal conformity as much as it encouraged a state-sponsored spirit of intolerance. Yet unlike the European Inquisition, Safavid Iran never institutionalized systematic intrusion in the life of individuals. The urge for greater legitimacy in the face of charges of heresy by Sunni neighbors also persuaded the Safavids to refashion their own ancestry. Although Ismail, and perhaps his father, Haydar, did claim to be of the house of Ali, Ali Ali, it was from the time of Tahmasp that a thorough holy genealogy traced the ruling house back to Ali ibn Musa Riza, the 8th Shi'i Imam, whose shrine in Mashhad was the most venerated site in Safavid Iran. Accredited by contemporary sources and up to the 20th century, the association with Ali and the House of the Prophet elevated the status of the Safavid dynasty, attaching to it an aura of sanctity evident in many architectural edifices of the period, in public decrees, and in works of scholarship patronized by the Safavid Shahs. Ties to the Sufi origins of the dynasty nevertheless remained strong, and symbolic dedication to the shrine of the patriarch of the house reaffirmed the loyalties of the followers of the Safavi order to the person of the Shah. Tahmasp himself became an obsessive observer of Shi'i purity laws. Whether out of a desire to serve as a role model for his subjects, or more likely because of a compulsive disorder, in contrast to his father's excessive drinking, Tahmasp in his youth repented and abstained from drinking for the rest of his life. Karaki even wrote, at Tahmasp's request, a tract on the legal implications of obsessive behaviour, Vasvors. One could surmise that the royal's behaviour was not entirely unrelated to a surge in works produced on the intricacies of ritual purity, a favourite subject of Shi'i jurists. It stands to reason that the purity-impurity dichotomy, which Shi'i Islam liberally transposes into xenophobic distancing from non-believers, was also exacerbated by the threat of Sunni enemies on the Iranian frontiers. Tahmasp's short autobiography, A Window onto His Moral World, reveals deep religious convictions, often in the forms of holy dreams, dreams that served as a guiding light connecting his personal life with a crusading mission in defense of Shi'ism. Resisting Ottoman Hegemony. Tahmasp was a contemporary of the greatest, and perhaps the most belligerent Ottoman sultan, Suleiman I, known as the Lawgiver, Kanuni, and to Europeans as Suleiman the Magnificent, reigned 1520-1566. Son of Selim I, Suleiman's reign is synonymous with the peak of Ottoman military power and its flourishing material culture. For Suleiman's neighbours, however, whether the Iranians, Armenians, or Georgians in the east, or the Hungarians, Serbs, Poles, Austrians, or a host of other nations in the west, all of whom sustained the brunt of Turkish expansionism and devastating Ottoman campaigns, there was nothing magnificent or lawful about him. In the Iranian case, the sustained threat of Ottoman offensives was evident in three rounds of massive campaigns undertaken in 1534-1535, 1548-1549, and 1554-1555. The campaigns were stifled, largely because of the same logistical problems that earlier had hindered Selim. They were launched under the pretext of securing the eastern Ottoman frontiers, and presumably aimed to sever Safavid influence over Ottoman subjects in eastern Anatolia. A low-intensity anti-Ottoman Jalali revolt among Alawite Shi'is was endemic to the region, but was largely independent of the Safavids, and certainly did not require an extensive military operation into the interior of Iran. In reality, what motivated Suleiman to undertake these arduous campaigns of conquest and to move his war machine, larger and more terrifying than that of his father, was territory. Plunder and slavery, including the capture of both Shi'is of Iran and Christians of the Caucasus, also served as incentives. The disloyalty of the Gezilbash chiefs of Azerbaijan and other western provinces also rendered opportunities for the Ottomans at times of commotion and revolt. The quarrelling Gezilbash, whose privileges were threatened by Tahmasp's balancing act, setting one division against the other, were increasingly restive, even treasonous. The Safavids' oppressive enforcement of Shi'ism also opened new doors to Ottoman conquest. In 1535, the population of Baghdad and the whole of the Sunni Mesopotamia, who were resentful of Shi'i hegemony, welcomed the Ottomans. The loss of Mesopotamia made the Safavids' western defences vulnerable, enabling the Ottomans to consolidate in eastern Anatolia and to occupy for decades Safavid provinces in the eastern Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Hamadan, and Kermanshah, Khuzestan, and the Persian Gulf coasts. Yet the Ottoman culture of conquest could not always effectively produce durable gains in the east as it did in the Balkans and Eastern Europe. The Safavids employed the same scorched-earth tactics that earlier had persuaded Selim's forces to withdraw. Like his father, Suleiman could not hold on to Tabriz for long and was forced to evacuate at the end of the campaign season, resorting to the more fertile and less hazardous valleys of the western Caucasus. The lure of the Caucasus for the Ottomans and Safavids, who fought long and hard for it, was not only its fertile land and green pastures where their armies could recuperate. For both empires, the Caucasus and the land farther to the north, into the interiors of southern Russia, was a desirable source of white slaves. Under the pretext of crusade, Khaza, rural Christians of Armenia and Georgians, as well as the pagan Circassians, Chechens, Leks, Lesghians, and a host of other tribal peoples from the mountains of the northern Caucasus, were prey for Turkish and Persian armies. On the Iranian side, the more organized and more destructive campaigns under Tahmasp, four of them between 1540 and 1554, seem to have been modeled on the Ottoman method of conquest, and with the idea of creating a system similar to the slave recruitment practice known as devşirme in the Balkans and other Western Ottoman possessions, whereby young Christian boys were systematically rounded up as a form of tribute for service in the Ottoman army and administration. For the Safavids, the white slaves captured in raids across the Caucasus were valuable for replenishing their diminishing and disloyal old guards from among the Gezilbash. Female slaves from the Caucasus, too, were sought after for both the Safavid and the Ottoman royal harems. A majority of Tahmasp's wives were recognized as Georgians, a general term for all Caucasian slaves from north of Tiflis, now Tbilisi. Female slaves also populated the harems of the princes and the military elites. During the latter part of Tahmasp's reign, in a single raid to the Georgian interior in 1553, no fewer than 30,000 Christians were captured and brought back to Safavid territory. Either through raids or as part of the annual tribute imposed on the newly subdued Caucasian vassals, the population of slave origins significantly increased. The Safavids forced their captives to convert, though not as systematically as the Ottomans did. They were also zealous in destroying the Caucasian symbols of cultural and religious identity, including churches and shrines. In 1551, during the Safavid raid of southern Georgia, aimed at the mountain fortress of Vardzya, known as Dezbad in the Safavid sources, west of the Kara River, Tahmasp, the refuge of Islam, waged a horrific crusade against the Georgian cursed infidels. The victorious Safavid army gutted the great 12th-century Georgian cave monastery inside the fortress and massacred the local population who had taken refuge there. "Not a single breathing soul," declared the chronicler Rumlu, "from among those infidels could escape unharmed from the vengeance of the troops. Their wives, households, properties, and belongings were all transferred by the law of the Sharia from the killed to the killer. The fair-faced Georgians, those fairy-like creatures, each a rarity like a beauty spot on the face of the time, took refuge in high mountains, in deep caves, and in neighboring fortresses. But the courageous army of Islam moved in to rout them out with their well-watered swords and their artillery defenses, hence dispatching a few thousand of them to the bottom of hell. Like a swarming army of bees in front of a beehive, the troops went on plundering and expropriating the treasures of the caves, and group after group the terrified fairy-faced slaves, golams, came out in thirst and in fear of their lives. The impact of the imported slaves, the golams, Arabic, presumably from ghola, collar, on the royal household, the army, and entire Safavid system, was immediate and, over the long term, immense. A shift in the concept of golam, connoting a young male lover of slave origin, to a white or black slave in military, administrative, or court service, happened centuries earlier. By Safavid times, although the sexual undertones remained in place, the functionality of the golams took higher priority from the middle of the 16th century, as the number of Christian captives, carried off in the Caucasus raids, substantially increased. Through the harem and the military, the golam element amounted to a third force, a counterbalance to the Gezilbash and the administrators of the divan. Similar to the Ottoman janissaries, the introduction of the golam recruits injected fresh blood into the Safavid army, with more loyalty to the person of the Shah. It can even be argued that the golam element made it possible for the Safavids to recapture their lost western provinces. The impact of Ottoman offensives and unreliability of the Safavid tribal army had already persuaded Tahmasp to reduce his reliance on the Gezilbash, and in 1548 to transfer his capital from the militarily insecure Tabriz to Ghazvin, 300 miles east into the Iranian interior. Although Tabriz maintained its commercial and cultural prominence at least for another half century, the decision to move to the Persian-speaking interior and away from the original Gezilbash base in Azerbaijan was a turning point in the further Persianization of the Safavid Empire. Even more important for the political and diplomatic history of Iran was concluding the peace treaty of Amasya in 1555, the first Safavid-Ottoman diplomatic settlement of their territorial disputes. The Peace of Amasya, located in today's north-central Turkey, demarcated for the first time the boundaries of the rival empires. While Iraq and almost the whole of Anatolia went to the Ottomans, the treaty restored to Iranian sovereignty Azerbaijan and the rest of the western Iranian provinces from Kurdistan to Kermanshah, Hamadan, Luristan, and Khuzestan, as well as the eastern Caucasus. Although both sides, especially the Ottomans, breached the terms of this treaty repeatedly, it remained in place more or less up to the 20th century, essentially defining Iran's western frontier. Despite the loss of territory, the treaty was a victory, not only because the Safavid defences endured and Persian armies occasionally even prevailed over the powerful Ottomans, to the point of facilitating peace negotiations, but also because it marked Tahmasp's victory over his unruly chiefs. By the 1550s, the quarrelling Gezilbash were subdued, the Uzbek offensive in the east had been repelled, and by 1550, the revolt of Tahmasp's brother, Al-Ghaz, who ironically had defected to the Ottoman side and furnished Suleiman with a pretext to attack Iran, was crushed. Cultural fluorescence and crises of succession. In the latter part of Tahmasp's reign, it seemed that the Safavid state had managed to stabilize, despite a sea of Sunni hostility and internal strife. Cities thrived, domestic trade flourished, and the integration of the provinces into a united empire was partially accomplished, at least in the interior. Safavid society recovered from the devastating campaigns of earlier decades, and the worst of the Gezilbash's violence appeared to have come to an end. Even a life of leisure, civility, thinking, and creativity seemed to have withstood the stern gaze of Shi'i jurists. The latter decades of the 16th century proved among the most exciting episodes in the history of Persian painting and art of book production. Royal workshops in Safavid Iran produced some of the most exquisite illustrated manuscripts of classical texts. Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, stories of Nezami's Khamseh, and Sa'adi's Golestan were among the most favoured. Elite women, who commissioned numerous manuscript copies, particularly favoured Nezami. In the neighbouring Ottoman and Mughal courts, too, a number of Persian artists residing there by choice or by force produced book illustrations and trained Turkish and Mughal artists, who in due course developed indigenous schools of painting. Relations with Mughal India, already expanding through trade with Kandahar and the Deccan, were complemented by new cultural exchanges. The 15-year refuge of Emperor Homayun, reigned 1531 to 1540, and 1555 to 1556, in the court of Tahmasp in Khazvin, after the Afghan warrior Sher Shah Suri overran the Mughal domains, expedited a remarkable era of cultural dialogue between the neighbouring empires. Homayun resisted conversion to Shi'ism, but he nurtured a taste for Persian art and culture. When, in 1555, Homayun returned to Delhi, he included in his retinue a large number of Persian master painters, craftsmen, and scholars who exerted great influence over Mughal and post-Mughal fine arts and literature. Although Tahmasp remained lukewarm toward the European emissaries who occasionally visited his court, he was keen to welcome friendly relations with his Mughal neighbour, no doubt to balance both the Ottoman and the Uzbek threats. In contrast to the Safavids, the Mughal tolerant religious policies, a legacy of Akbar's era moreover, encouraged an exodus of Persian artists, poets, and religious dissidents to Mughal India that continued well into the 18th century. Despite a fleeting interval of calm and prosperity, the final years of Tahmasp and the decade following his death, 1578 to 1588, witnessed an unparalleled period of disarray that soon swirled into political chaos. By 1588, the crises were so critical that the very survival of the Safavid state was in doubt. The empire that had been pieced together with Ismail's unremitting energy and held together with Tahmasp's perseverance for more than half a century was about to disintegrate into fiefdoms of quarrelling warlords, many of whom were Ghazilbash chiefs of the second and third generations. At the centre of this chaotic interlude was the unresolved problem of succession. Yet succession triggered a range of conflicts within the power structure, the most acute of which was quarrelling over land among the Ghazilbash chiefs and their subsequent ambition to control the Safavid throne. Persian political culture, at least informally, abided by the rule of primogeniture, the succession of the senior son as heir to the throne. This was the tradition that had brought Tahmasp himself to power. Yet there was the distinct absence of an institutional framework to allow for an orderly succession, and even less so, consensus to implement it. The Ghazilbash, to the extent that they were an integrated force, were hardly capable of arriving at a consensus over Tahmasp's successor, given the deep wounds that over the decades had spread through their ranks, some perpetrated by Tahmasp himself. The uneasy equilibrium achieved during Tahmasp's reign, based on a network of patron-client clans, Turkish Uymag, began to crumble. While some of the Ghazilbash members were descendants of the older elite, in reality the clans no longer were structured solely along bloodlines. They were more like party factions set up to protect the privilege of their members, to acquire more economic resources, and to monopolize political power. As old group loyalties weakened, and the Ghazilbash became accustomed to their privileges, their original confederacy showed serious cracks. By the end of the 16th century, they were no longer a reliable military force. Their vast land assignments in the provinces, generous government pensions, share of war booty, and high status as a class of military nobility made them more prone to factionalism and thirsty for power, a drive satiable only through the elaborate, often foolish conspiracies that have littered so many pages of Safavid chronicles. The Shah's many sons, who were potentially eligible for the throne, were desirable targets of Ghazilbash ambitions. As the early career of the young Abbas I, the ultimate successor to the throne, demonstrates, the Safavid princes were no more than puppets, whose only other refuge from their manipulative Ghazilbash guardians was their mothers and other female members of the royal household. Although from the early days of the Safavid rule, royal women played a distinctive, even decisive role in the political process, it was in the post-Tahmasp transition era that their presence became more tangible. Though seldom acknowledged, and often in an unfavourable misogynistic light, their agency clearly contested the male-conscious ethos of the Safavid polity. The implicit matriarchy of the Safavid elite, as in the Ottoman and Mughal courts, became more overt from the late 16th century. Known in Ottoman history as the Sultanate of the Women, the coincidence of women's influence was probably because all three empires experienced a similar, if not identical, pattern of political transition. Wives of the Safavid rulers were either of Christian slave origin or were party to a marriage of convenience, such as a political union with a subordinate or affiliate power. With the polygamy of the harem, ethnic rivalries were as rampant as clan feuds among the Ghazilbash, and mother-son bonds went a long way toward compensating for the lack of affection from the ruling father and the lack of prospects for succession. The rise of powerful royal women, especially in the period of instability, was thus indicative of the breakdown of a dysfunctional male polity, which in effect facilitated women's assertion of authority. Upon Tahmasp's death in 1578, these strains converged in a mini-revolution that stretched beyond the court. Tahmasp's oldest son, Mahamad, who was visually impaired, was passed over in favour of his promising brother, Ismail Mirza, then in long-term captivity by the order of his father Tahmasp in a remote fortress in Azerbaijan. Ismail Mirza's succession was made possible thanks to the political exuberance of Ismail Mirza's half-sister, Pari Khan Khanum, a politically astute princess from a Circassian mother who had been a confidant to Tahmasp. The three-way alliance forged among Pari Khan Khanum with some Kizilbash chiefs and the Circassian Gholams, successfully removed her half-brother, Haydar Mirza, from the succession contest and quashed his Kizilbash and Georgian support. Ascending the throne in Ghazvin as Ismail II, reigned 1576 to 1578, the new Shah, an eccentric opium addict with a temper, had his own agenda. His lethal mix of grudges and paranoia, the product of 20 years incarceration on charges of immorality, soon shook the empire. Brushing aside Pari Khan, the new Shah ordered a mass execution of nearly all the eligible princes of royal blood, including his own brothers, as well as the opposing chiefs of the Kizilbash and the Sufi guards at his court. Though brutal, the carnage was meant to consolidate Ismail's power, an anxious retraction, no doubt, of his father's delicate balancing act. Moreover, Ismail II entertained revisionist views critical of the religious policies of his father. What made his short and bloody reign remarkable was a desire to abandon the Safavids' extreme anti-Sunni propaganda and practice of insulting the early caliphs, and to put an end to forced conversions and other forms of Sunni persecution. He was daring enough to order the removal of anti-Sunni mottos from the walls of mosques and public places. He appointed two government offices, prominent Persian officials with well-known Sunni sympathies, in open defiance of the Arab jurists and their growing followings. Such measures were bound to cause uproar, not only within the Kizilbash and among the jurists, but also at large in a society exposed to decades of anti-Sunni propaganda. Ismail II's life soon came to a sudden end, for reasons not entirely unrelated to his radical revisionism. He was found unconscious in his private quarters, together with his lover, a young man of humble origins, after a night of nocturnal wandering through the taverns in the capital. Presumably, he died of an opium overdose, though his Kizilbash opponents, fearful of their own lives, may have had a hand in his death. The possibility of intrigue aside, the episode tested Iranian society's conversion to Shiism and the state's declared commitment to uphold its anti-Sunni stance. Cursing of the caliphs and other forms of Sunni othering were destined to remain the lifeblood of the Safavid ideology. It is possible to imagine that were it not for his mysterious death, Ismail II and his supporters would have been able to overcome the rabid ideologues and allow for a more inclusive society with lesser harassment of non-conformists, fewer clashes with Sunni neighbours, and perhaps even a decoupling of the state from Shiism as its official creed. Ismail II's death plunged the Safavid state and the empire into a decade-long court intrigue and an ensuing contest for succession, resolved only through a protracted civil war. Lacking any other choice, a council of the Kizilbash chiefs, who temporarily reached a semblance of unanimity after Ismail II's death, brought to the throne Tahmasp's senior son, Sultan Muhammad, reigned 1578 to 1588, with the throne name Khodabandeh, God's slave. He proved a mere nominal ruler over a Kizilbash oligarchy. Real power behind the throne emanated from inside the harem, where Kheir ul-Nisa, Sultan Muhammad's wife, soon emerged as a serious rival to Pari Khan, who had lost prominence after the death of her brother Ismail II. Better known as Mahda ul-Ya, literally the sublime cradle, Kheir ul-Nisa, daughter of a powerful semi-autonomous governor of Gilan province, was mother of the then-infant crown prince, the future Shah Abbas I. As Sultan Muhammad's effective regent, Mahda ul-Ya quickly arranged for the murder of Pari Khan Khanum and removed her Circassian faction from the court. Yet she could not easily overcome the Kizilbash's desire to hold collective but decentralized sway over her husband. Even hefty payoffs for many years of outstanding salaries could not guarantee their loyalty. On the contrary, a fresh Ottoman invasion of the Safavid Caucasian provinces furnished the Kizilbash with an excuse to scold Mahda ul-Ya for her reluctance to annul the 1555 peace treaty and go to war with the Ottomans. Unwilling to put up with her, in 1579, a group of Kizilbash chiefs broke into the royal harem en masse, pulled Mahda ul-Ya from her husband's arms, and cut her to pieces. The trumped-up charge against her was having an illicit affair with a Tatar prince of the Crimean Giray dynasty, who was then residing as a refugee in the Khazvin court. The internal bickering offered the Ottomans a fresh opportunity to march deeper into Safavid territory. A passage in Al-Maraye Abbasi, an official Safavid chronicle of the early 17th century, by Iskander Beg Manshi, himself a Gezilbash, depicts the complexity of the ongoing power struggle. As the Shah, Sultan Muhammad, began to give out from the royal treasury with exceeding generosity, every day chest after chest of golden coins was brought in from the treasury and given to the army officers in abundance. Because of hard-headed and self-serving conduct of the Gezilbash, their affairs turned into conflict and animosity, and duality permeated within military ranks. As the news of contention and lack of discipline among the Gezilbash spread, and as terrible faults began to appear in the state, the enemies among the rulers of the time, who were awaiting such a day, welcomed the opportunity and nursed new ambitions toward the land of Iran from the east and from the west. Between 1578 and 1590, while the Safavid Empire was at its weakest, the Ottoman Sultan Murad III reigned 1574 to 1595, in clear breach of the 1555 peace treaty of Amasya, conducted at least four devastating campaigns to capture Azerbaijan and the Caucasus. The 1584 Ottoman campaign, reportedly consisting of 300,000 troops and 600 guns, attacked under the empty pretexts of relieving the Christian Caucasus from Iranian oppression and avenging the murder of Ismail II. In the course of several engagements, the Gezilbash defences crumbled, and the Ottoman forces once more occupied all of the western Safavid provinces, from Georgia and Armenia to western Azerbaijan, Kurdistan, Luristan, and Khuzestan. After bloody battles in 1585, Tabriz fell, and this time the Ottomans were there to stay. They retaliated indiscriminately against the resistant population, destroyed some of the city's most important wards, built new fortifications, and for the first time sold the captive Shi'i men, women, and children to slavery or to indenture in the Ottoman European provinces. Devastating raids by the Uzbeks into the Safavid Khorasan soon followed. The periodic occupations of Balkh, Marv, and even Mashhad exposed the Safavids' strategic weaknesses in the face of a two-front offensive and led to the enslavement of the local Shi'i population, who was carried away and sold in slave markets of Central Asia. The fatwas of the Sunni muftis in Istanbul and Bukhara legitimized enslaving the Safavid subjects on the grounds of their heretic Shi'i beliefs. The Safavids retaliated by capturing Turkmen slaves, Asire Turkoman. Abbas Mirza as the Crown Prince. In the midst of civil strife and foreign invasion, the governor of Herat, a Gezilbash chief, by the name of Ali Goleh Khan Shamlu, had other ideas in mind. As early as 1581, he declared the 10-year-old Abbas Mirza the prince in his custody, the nominal Safavid Shah of Khorasan. The rift between eastern and western Gezilbash persuaded Ali Goleh to unify Khorasan and carve out a power base for himself independent from Khazvin and the western Gezilbash. Abbas Mirza, the third son of Sultan Muhammad and his slain wife, Mahde Olya, had miraculously escaped execution during the 1578 carnage of Ismail II. It was clear that Ali Goleh and his ally, Murshed Goleh Khan, an ambitious and capable chief of the Ostajlu Gezilbash, were uncertain of the fate of the government in Khazvin. Fearing occupation of the capital by the invading Ottomans, they sought in the young Abbas Mirza a candidate to form a new Gezilbash confederacy in the east. By 1587, the Gezilbash were so divided that even a meagre Ostajlu force of 2,000 horsemen, under the command of Murshed Goleh, was able to march successfully on Khazvin. Ironically, the Ostajlu chief and the prince in his charge, Abbas Mirza, opted for Khazvin only because they were pushed out of Khorasan by recurring Uzbek raids. Backed by the people of Khazvin, utterly disgusted with 10 years of civil war, the young Abbas Mirza and his regent were welcomed to the city. By October 1587, Sultan Muhammad had finally abdicated, and shortly afterward his 18-year-old son was enthroned as Shah Abbas. Wearing his jewel-encrusted royal crown, the new Shah was already entertaining in secret the destruction of the Gezilbash and all they represented. His intent was not much different from Ismail II's a decade earlier, and his chances of success did not seem to be any better. Less than a century after its inception, the prospects for the Safavid state seemed ambivalent at best. What Ismail I and Tahmasp had tried to achieve had been undermined by domestic factionalism and foreign invasion. By 1588, the two most important Safavid cities, Tabriz and Herat, were under occupation, as were vast provinces of the empire's flanks. The Gezilbash had divided the remaining provinces into shaky fiefdoms, and the impoverished population had suffered civil war, oppression, and enslavement. The Safavid central state had sunk to its lowest ebb through machination and incompetence. Yet there were resilient features that, in the face of many calamities, distinguished the Safavid enterprise from its ephemeral Turkmen predecessors, and even from its powerful neighbouring empires. Despite its many failings, Safavid Iran was able to forge a sense of socio-religious conformity bound by territorial constraints. As in few other early modern states, Spain and England, for example, conversion to a state-sponsored creed, in this case Shi'ism, served as the social and moral mortar necessary to hold together the building blocks of a soon rejuvenated empire. Whether by force or by persuasion, the Shi'i creed prevailed and endured. Early Safavid Iran remained vulnerable to the superior firepower of its Ottoman neighbour, but less vulnerable to the Ottomans' growing sense of Sunni identity. Although repeated Ottoman invasions and Uzbek sorties were meant to extinguish Ismail's messianic project, perhaps no other factor contributed more to the very survival of Shi'i Iran and to its gradual conversion to normative 12-air Shi'ism. Forging a new communal identity within the natural confines of Iran perhaps could not have been achieved without such tumultuous experiences. The Safavids did not initiate an Iranian sense of nationhood, nor did they define Iran as a political entity. The former would emerge, in the modern sense of the term, only centuries later. The latter had been a geopolitical reality for many centuries. What the Safavid state did was help anticipate one and solidify the other. The early Safavid experience demonstrated that southern Mesopotamia, eastern Anatolia, and southern parts of Central Asia could no longer be easily incorporated into Iran proper, despite common Persianate, cultural, religious, and ethnic ties. Ismail's world-conquering project was bound to stop at the threshold of Iran's natural frontiers.